From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the American Jazz Museum in Kansas City began a two-day tribute to Charlie Parker. On today's Fresh Air, we remember Parker with interviews featuring two people who played with him, the great drummer Max Roach, who helped create the language of bebop with Parker. And from the archives, we'll hear from the late trumpeter Red Rodney, who joined Parker's band in 1949, replacing Miles Davis. Also today, one of the leading interpreters of Thelonious Monk's music, soprano saxophonist and composer Steve Lacy. He's known as the father of the modern soprano saxophone. Lacy lives in Paris, but he's currently on an American tour. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, the American Jazz Museum in Kansas City began a two-day tribute to Charlie Parker, one of the founders of bebop and one of the most influential performers in the history of jazz. He spent his early years in Kansas City. On Saturday, the Charlie Parker Memorial will be unveiled at the city's famous intersection of 18th and Vine. On today's Fresh Air, we remember Charlie Parker with two musicians who played with him. First, drummer Max Roach, who's participating in the museum tribute. He's one of the inventors of modern jazz drumming. Together with Parker, Miles Davis, and Dizzy Gillespie, Roach helped formulate the language of bebop. In the mid-50s, Roach teamed up with trumpeter Clifford Brown to form what many jazz fans regarded as the quintessential bop group of the time. In the early 60s, Roach recorded the album We Insist, the Freedom Now Suite, some of the first jazz inspired by the Civil Rights Movement. Our interview was recorded in 1987. Here's Max Roach with Charlie Parker on the 1953 recording Confirmation. First drummers to play bebop, and you were one of the first people to figure out how to drum in the kind of fiery sessions that were being played. What were some of the challenges that that presented to you?
Well, when they played fast, they played very fast. It was a period where instrumental virtuosity was in our area, in the jazz area, was now prevailed. Because during the war, you know, we had an extra, the Second World War, we had an extra 20% cabaret taxes, very complex. Simply, to put it very simply, it was if an entrepreneur hired, he had to pay for, say, he had to pay a city tax, like in New York, he had to pay a state tax and a federal tax. And upon that, he had, on top of that, he had to pay a 20% government tax called entertainment tax if he had a singer, if he had public dancing or dancing on a stage or a comedian. This really heralded the demise of big bands during that time. This tax was just awful, you know. So the people who really got the jobs were the virtuoso instrumentalists. Everybody went home and practiced, and then that was the beginning of bebop, like the people who, so Charlie Parker and Dizzy and Shearing, the virtuoso players were the ones who people would come and sit down. Everybody began to sit and listen to the music rather than get up and dance to it. That was the beginning of it.
What rhythms had you been playing before? And what rhythms did you shift into playing when you started playing bop? Because you really had to invent new rhythms.
And yeah,
you
well,
had to
invent also, new style. I had help, too. I had a lot of help. I had my my mentors were people like Big Sidney Catlett and Chick Webb and Joe Jones with the Count Basie Band. For folks who don't know, these were people who played with Louis Armstrong and Sidney Catlett did, and later went with Benny Goodman. Sidney Catlett took Gene Krupa's place when Krupa started his own band. But all these folks, they were doing pretty much the same thing, but only in large band contexts. When you played in a small band, you had to do more. More was required of you because there were less people. It was like playing in a string quartet vis-a-vis a symphony orchestra. It's much more interesting for the individual player. Of course, an orchestra is interesting for the composer and the conductor and the soloist. But when you play in a smaller context, everybody has to do more to fill up the sound. So this was required of us, actually. I don't think we were aware of it, excepting that that very small band I worked in, the first one was Dizzy's. I worked in small bands, of course, all around the city at that time, but Dizzy was the one that his band with Charlie Parker and Oscar Pettiford and Bud Powell or Charles Mingus, that was all the virtuoso people got together. And we knew that everybody had to be kind of busy. So consequently, you heard more drums, you heard more piano, you heard more this and that and the other to fill it out. That's to put it very simply, of course.
Right. Well, to put it less simply, we'll hear some of what you were playing then. This is from the mid-1940s, and this is my guest, Max Roach, as recorded with Miles Davis and Charlie Parker, and we're going to hear Coco. Coco is recorded in 1945 with my guest Max Roach on drums and Miles Davis on trumpet, Charlie Parker on alto saxophone. Does it bring back memories for you? Do you listen back to that
much?
It
sure does. It'd be Charlie Parker at that time, as well as Dizzy. The music was very, very fresh, and I guess you would equate it with what we hear today from people like Anthony Braxton. At least they treated us that way. We were the new breed on the scene, and And they would say things, well, the critics would say, Dizzy sounds like he's playing with a mouthful of marbles. And Charlie Parker was playing scales from a saxophone book, just only scales. And Max Roach dropped bombs. I don't know, but it was interesting. Bud Powell had no left hand. And it was you know, we were criticized. But some of it was valid, I thought. You know, we had a long way to go.
Max Roach, recorded in 1987, he's participating in the two-day tribute to Charlie Parker, which began today at the American Jazz Museum in Kansas City. On April 26th, Roach will perform in New York and receive a Harlem Renaissance Award. Coming up, a 1990 interview with the late trumpeter Red Rodney about playing in Parker's band. This is Fresh Air. Charlie Parker is the subject of a two-day tribute at the American Jazz Museum in Parker's hometown, Kansas City. We're remembering Parker on today's Fresh Air.
Dizzy took me up to New York one Sunday, sat me in the middle of the Three Deuces and to hear his band, and I heard Charlie Parker. It was like a religious experience. I was completely overwhelmed. I remember leaving that place 4 o'clock in the morning and walking around like I didn't know what to do, where to go, how to think, but I knew what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. That's how powerful that affected me.
That was trumpeter Red Rodney. In 1949, after playing in the bands of Claude Thornhill, Gene Krupa, and Woody Herman, Rodney ended up in the place just about every young jazz musician then wanted to be, Charlie Parker's band. Parker hired Rodney to replace Miles Davis. Rodney left the band a couple of years later, and his career floundered in part due to a drug habit. He made a comeback in the 70s and played until his death in 1994. I spoke with Red Rodney in 1990. One of the celebrated stories in jazz lore is a story that was also recounted in the movie Bird, and that's the story of how during one of your tours through the South with Charlie Parker, he knew that an integrated band wouldn't go over well in the segregated South, that there were places you wouldn't be allowed to play. So he had the band advertised as Charlie Parker with albino red, so you were passed off as a black albino. This is a true story, right?
Yes, it is. We didn't fool anybody.
Uh-huh.
Everybody was very nice, and he had me sing a blues, and like the kid in the movie did. I think I sang better than that, though.
So. Is the story true that you ended up moving to a white hotel, and Parker said, I'll come with you, you could call me your valet?
Yeah, and they didn't show that in the movie. They should have, because that was hilarious. It would have been much better than the story they put in there in a hotel where he asked me to kick him in his rear end, and that never happened.
So tell me the valet story.
Well, after about a week or 10 days, we were in Atlanta, and I saw this big, beautiful hotel, and I said, you know, I'm going to go check in there. I'm going to take a bath. I'm sorry, but I'm doing this. He says, that's a good idea, and I can go with you as your valet. And I thought he was crazy, but he knew the South. If any white man at that time would register and say, John Jones and valet, they would not question it, and they'd give the valet a room along with him. And that's what happened. I remember him trying to send me downstairs to get cigarettes and newspaper. I said, no, you got to go down. You're the valet.
Let me play something that you recorded with Parker. Let's hear Parker's composition, Blues for Alice. And would you like to say anything about your memories of this recording session?
Well, that particular session, I was playing in the Jewish Alps, the Catskill Mountains. And all of a sudden, I got a phone call. Well, I'm in the swimming pool, and he said, you better get down here quickly. Norman Granz is doing a record date with us, and told me the studio, and I said, I'll be right down. Well, it took three, four hours to get there, but I made it, and that was it. That was the Blues for Alice Swedish Schnapps date. I think it's called Swedish Schnapps, the album. At least originally it was.
Uh-huh. So this is Charlie Parker with Red Rodney on trumpet, John Lewis at the piano, Ray Brown on bass, Kenny Clark drums. Thank you. I guess Red Rodney on trumpet, and that recording of Blues for Alice, recorded with Charlie Parker and Red Rodney. Well, Charlie Parker eventually hired you to replace Miles Davis. Did you feel prepared for that?
Not really. No, I told him, too. I told him I really wasn't ready for that. And he said, well, let me be the judge of that. He said, I know a good trumpet player when I hear one, and I think you are ready, and you'll be more ready once you come. And, of course, I grabbed it. I often say that was like going to college and graduate school, the 3.5 years I played with him.
Did Parker take you under his wing in addition to taking you into his band?
Well, I don't know about that. We were very friendly even before that. And, of course, we became more friendly when I was working for him. I was thrilled that a man like that could like me. I don't think I like myself very much, but I was really thrilled that he did. And I guess you might say he took me under his wing a little bit, yeah. Of course, when he saw that I was trying to emulate him, he protested violently.
Emulate him in which way?
Well, in his drug use. And, he got very, very upset, and of course he didn't like it at all.
Do you think one of the reasons why he hired you was that you weren't using?
I don't think he thought of that. No, I don't think so. But I know it would have been... it would have been more difficult if I were. I don't think he would have wanted to be involved with that. It was enough for him than to have somebody else messing around like that.
Did you start using heroin as a way to emulate him? Is that what it was about?
Yes, I was very immature, and I kept looking and looking and saying, oh, my God, if I cross that line, could I possibly play like that? Curiosity killed the cat, you know, and pretty soon... you wind up with a little habit. You don't play any better. In fact, you don't really live up to your potential because you have to be healthy to play well. And there it is. It took me years to get away from it.
Mm-hmm. What did Parker do to try to discourage you? Anything? Discourage you from using?
Well, many things. He threatened to fire me every day. he let me know... in no uncertain terms, how terrible a thing it was and how he couldn't handle it, what made me think that I could. Well, it turned out that it killed our greatest, or one of our greatest musical giants at the age of 34. And the young kid that was there, who was able to get straight, is now 63 years old and fairly successful. So there's the paradox.
Trumpeter Red Rodney recorded in 1990. He died in 1994. The Charlie Parker Symposium is being held today and tomorrow at the American Jazz Museum in Kansas City. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Antioch University, a place for writers. On the web at www.antioch.edu or 937-767-6494. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, composer Steve Lacy on bringing the soprano saxophone into modern jazz. Lacy started his career playing a hybrid of modern jazz and Dixieland, then played with two of the greatest innovators in jazz, Cecil Taylor and Thelonious Monk. Lacy has lived in Paris for many years. He's currently on an American tour. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Steve Lacy brought the soprano saxophone into contemporary jazz, and in the estimation of many critics, is the best soprano player in jazz. Early in his career, he apprenticed with jazz traditionalists and avant-gardists. Since the mid-60s, he's lived mainly in Europe. He's currently on an American tour. Before we hear from him, let's listen to one of Lacy's compositions, featured on his recent CD, Baya. This is called The Hoot. In 1997, I asked Steve Lacy about the qualities of the soprano saxophone. I asked him to compare it to the tenor and alto.
Well, of course, it's higher up, and it's smaller, and it's more to the brain, really.
To the brain. What does
this
mean?
It's like at the head of things. It's the, in the treble clef. It's not down below in the chest. It's up in the head, really. It's like a soprano singer, really, compared to a tenor singer.
Now, you came at the soprano after having played clarinet first. A lot of musicians come to soprano after playing another form of saxophone. Mm-hmm. Do you think coming at it from clarinet affected your approach to soprano?
Well, I really came out of the piano. I played the piano when I was a kid, very poorly, but with interest, especially mm-hmm. when I discovered jazz. I try to play jazz on it. And I play it foolishly myself still, but not in public. So the piano is really very important to me. It's at the center of my musical thinking. But the soprano sax is my working voice, really.
You've said that certain parts of the soprano's range are inherently out of tune with the rest of the horn. What part of the range is that, and why is that so?
Well, there are notes here that are too flat and others that are too sharp. It's a little bit, maybe because it's conical rather than cylindrical. And it's sort of a bastard instrument in a way that it needs to be doctored personally. You have to really favor certain... But, I mean, this is true of a lot of instruments, really. Alto also has funny regions that you have to favor. that you have to, you know, push up, push down, and compensate for the inherent difficulties in the instrument itself.
Does this mean that you need to have a really good ear for pitch in order to play the soprano? And did you have to work hard to develop your ear?
You have to suffer. Or I had to suffer, really, some really hard periods where it was really out of tune, where I just couldn't fix it, really. This was years and years ago, in the 50s, when I was struggling with the instrument. It was very difficult at that time to get it in tune. And now, after all these years, it's much easier, but I have to watch it all the time.
Well, how's your sense of pitch? Do you have perfect pitch?
No, I have a relative pitch, but I have a perfect internal pitch. So I can compose music from inside, but I don't have perfect pitch at all.
Now, the soprano has a naturally nasal and shrill sound in its highest notes. Is that something that you feel like you fight against or try to exploit?
It doesn't have that at all, really. It doesn't mm-hmm. need to have that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just poor playing, you know. Even John Coltrane, when he first played the instrument, he had trouble up there, and it came out nasal and all that. But after a while, it opened up. It's just like your nose, really. If you breathe through your nose, it's all about breathing, really, and it's also about conception. And when you have experience of the horn, it opens up, and it doesn't have to be nasal there at all. But that's one of the reasons I don't play the other saxophones, because I really want to just be faithful to that one, really.
What was your role in inspiring John Coltrane to try soprano saxophone?
Well, I was sort of the model. In other words, he heard me play it, and he thought it was like he was shopping, and I was modeling. So he heard me with, I was playing with Jimmy Giuffre at the Five Spot, and he came in and he heard me play, and he was intrigued by the instrument, and he asked me what key it was in, and when I told him it was B-flat, he said, oh, yeah? And then a couple of weeks later, Don Cherry called me from Chicago, and he said, listen to this, and he held the telephone up, and I could hear Train playing the soprano.
What did you think of what you first heard of his?
Well, I had a laugh, really. But, well, I thought, wow, it's nice to have some company.
You're not saying what you thought of the playing.
No, I mean, it sounded intriguing to me. I liked it, really. It sounded uh-huh. good. I mean, you know, if Don Cherry calls you up and said, listen to this, it's probably going to be good.
Steve Lacy, who else was playing soprano when you started to play in the 50s?
Nobody, really. It was in complete disuse. It had gone out of a phase. Like the musicians had considered it. You know, people played it in the 20s and the 30s, and it went by the 40s. I mean, even Johnny Hodges stopped in 1942, and it from that point on, it disappeared because it had a reputation for being out of tune, and arrangers didn't know what to do with it, and it just fell into disuse. I think the only person that I knew of playing it was a student of Bechet's, who was Bob Wilbur, and he was playing exactly like Bechet, really, and that's all.
And
nobody else was playing it.
What were the pros and cons of feeling like you had the field to yourself?
Well, the advantages were many. I didn't compete with anybody. I didn't threaten anybody else's job, so that I was welcomed into all these traditional bands that I played with. My teacher, Cecil Scott, took me around and had me sit in with the likes of Red Allen, Pee Wee Russell, and all these people. And after a while, I started getting hired and working with all these original masters who were at the peak of their form, really. They were in their 50s and 60s. I was 19, 20. And that's how I cut my teeth, really. I learned from playing with these people. And it was the New Orleans School and the Chicago School and the Kansas City School.
And the disadvantages?
And the disadvantages were nobody hired me after a while.
Because they didn't know what to do with you?
Well, the traditional, yeah, I stopped playing the clarinet. See, I was working with Max Kaminsky regularly, and I was playing soprano and clarinet, and it was working very well. And I decided to concentrate only on the soprano at that point, because I think I was starting to play with Cecil Taylor also. And when I told Max I'm not going to play the clarinet anymore, he said, "You're crazy. You won't get any work at all." And it was true. Those people, I stopped working with them, and I started to play with Cecil Taylor.
Let me play something that was part of your recording debut. This was made, I think it was 1954, when you were, I believe, 20 years old, in a kind of traditional jazz group led by Dick Sutton.
Mm-hmm.
And you played both clarinet and soprano in this. We'll hear you on soprano on a recording of Liza. You want to say anything about this session before we hear it?
Well, that was a young band. They called it Progressive Dixieland. It was Dick Sutton's conception, and it was influenced by Mulligan and by Bix Beiderbecke and Miles, and it was like a hybrid movement. It had some freshness to it. It was good.
An interesting concept and interesting music as well. So this is Liza with my guest Steve Lacy on soprano saxophone, recorded in 1954, his recording debut. A 1954 recording of Liza with Steve Lacy on soprano saxophone. We'll talk more with Steve Lacy after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with soprano saxophonist and composer Steve Lacy. A couple of years after playing modern Dixieland in the mid-50s, Steve Lacy joined a group led by avant-gardist Cecil Taylor. I asked Lacy about that shift in his direction.
Well, yeah, it was a radical change, that's for sure. But Cecil had very strong traditional roots also, and we both had a shared interest in the Ellington line, and that's like a line that covers a lot of ground, really, and goes through. See, I was playing with Don Fry at Jimmy Ryan's when I met Cecil, and that was like the Ellington, James P. Johnson line, all that, that's traditional. And Cecil also comes from, like, Duke Ellington and Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell. And this is another tradition, but in a way they're the same. It's the same story. It's just one ocean of jazz, really.
You continue to play in different styles of jazz and to pick up from different periods, and you still play free sometimes, and you play standards, and you play a lot of original compositions.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think now about free improvisation? What do you like about doing it? What do you think are its limitations?
Well, it was very important to have done that. And some people are still doing that, and I do it once in a while, and it's at the heart of what we do. It depends who you're playing with. The answer is it depends who you're playing with. When I play with Derek Bailey, there's no paper. There's no words said. There's nothing to say. We just get up and play. And when I there are several other people that we play like that with, normally, I prefer a more structured situation where there is a composed part and an improvised part, and there is a form and there is a content that is partially prepared. That's just my own metabolism. But as I say, it depends who you're playing with. The thing is, you want to get the best results out of the other players that you play with, so you have to turn them on.
Cecil Taylor took you to hear Thelonious Monk, and that, I think, really changed your music, too. When you heard Monk and became very excited by his harmonies and his rhythms, his odd rhythms, I'm wondering how you translated some of that to soprano. For example, a lot of Monk's music is based on these really unusual, interesting harmonies, very often dissonant harmonies, and you're playing a single line instrument.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't make chords on a soprano saxophone. So is there a way you feel you were able to apply some of his harmonic thinking into your horn?
Well, first of all, I play the piano as a laboratory, and I learned all his tunes at the piano, really, with the chords and everything, with the sounds, with the intervals and the voicings as much as I could. And then working on my horn, you can't play a chord all at once, but you can delineate it, you can outline it, you can express it. There is a way to express everything on everything, if you can find it. It's a question of imagination.
Monk invited you to join his quartet, making the group a quintet for the 4 months that you were there. Do you have any idea why he asked you to join? I mean, obviously he liked what you were doing.
Well, I think he was intrigued with the sound of the horn, the novelty of it, and he found something. And also he knew me. I knew him for a few years, and I was really on his case. I was recording his music and coming to see him all the time, every night, and talking, you know. So he was familiar with me. He knew me and all that, And he knew I was really not an expert, but an aficionado of his music. And maybe he thought I needed the experience. That's what I like to think. I like to think that he gave me that opportunity to really see what was happening from the inside.
And what did you learn seeing the music from the inside? What are some things you got from actually playing with Monk and talking with him?
I learned to stick to the point and to not lose the point and not get carried away, and to play with the other musicians and not to get all wrapped up in my own thing, and not to just play interesting notes just to be interesting, you know, or weird notes just to be weird. He mostly told me what not to do. He never told me what to do, but he told me what not to do when I did something that bothered him. For example, when I played, when we were playing together, sometimes he would play something on the piano and I would pick that up and play that on my horn. I thought I was being slick, you know? And he stopped me. He said, "Don't do that. That's, you know, I'm the piano player. You play your part. I'm accompanying you. Don't pick up on my things." You know, he got me out of the thing of trying to be too hip. I was trying to be too hip, and it wasn't swinging sometimes, you know. Then he told me, make the drummer sound good. Because I was playing some things that confused the drummer because I was confused myself. And so the drummer was not swinging, you know. And Monk told me, no, make the drummer sound good. And that was an enormous help to me, really. It stopped me cold, really, and changed my focus. And Monk's thing, he told me, let things go by. Let certain things go by. Don't play everything. Just play certain things. Let other things go by. It's what you don't play that's very important, really, and that's extremely important.
A kind of intervals of laying out of the
space. Yeah. Space, using the space as time,
mm-hmm.
and using time and digging time as space.
You've been recording Monk compositions throughout your career, and I want to play one of the duets from a recent album called Five Facings, and it's a series of duets with five different other jazz musicians, and I want to play one of the duets that you recorded with Misha Mengelberg, a Dutch pianist who's also very influenced by Monk. Let's hear your recording of Monk's Off Minor, a duet with the Dutch pianist Misha Mengelberg. And this was recorded in 1996. It seems to me on this, it's as if you on the soprano saxophone are playing the right hand and Misha Mengelberg on piano is playing the left hand.
Well, that's, in a way, I mean, I am a melodic instrument. All I can do is a single line of melody, and Misha has all the harmonic equipment down there, the armaments. He's armed to the teeth, really. He could do all that stuff, but he's got the taste and the discretion and the knowledge of Monk to complement what I do, and we always hit it off well together.
Okay, well, this is Off Minor. Steve Lacy and pianist Misha Mengelberg from Lacy's recent CD, Five Facings. We'll talk more with Lacy after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with composer and soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy. A few years ago, you did a kind of exercise book with a series of short essays. That elaborated some of your thinking about studying the instrument.
Yeah.
You have one exercise you call the No Baby exercise. Would you explain that for us?
Well, that comes from a piece that I wrote a long time ago. It was originally intended as a portrait of Sidney Bechet, who I imagined was talking to his girlfriend, and he was saying, no, baby, no, baby, no, baby, no, baby, like that. And that's how that piece began, really. And then I wrote a melody to go with that, which was a sort of a blues in unusual harmonies. And we played that for years and years and recorded and everything. And the idea of the exercise coming from that is the dynamics, the way of saying something each time louder, and the way of corresponding your saxophone to your own speech.
So, in other words, learning the things we already intuitively
language.
Know about speech
about
and
language.
Applying that to the instrument.
It's about language. My fundamental thing is about language, really. I deal with language.
Mm-hmm.
The jazz is language. The saxophone is language. And a lot of the music I write is based on literature and texts and language.
You recommend trying to sing and play whatever you hear.
Yeah.
Do you sing a lot as part of your exercise?
Well, yeah, that's very important. The connection with the voice, the ear, and the saxophone is fundamental. Is something I learned in Japan, actually, from a Zen master, a flute player, who gave me a couple of lessons. And that was the first lesson he gave me, was the connection with the ear, the voice, and the instrument, and the breath. And that was a huge revelation for me.
What was the connection that he made clear that you hadn't thought of before?
That my own voice was my own ear, was my own breath, was my own sound, that it was all one. That it, in the conception that it is, it's just one thing. It's got to be like one thing.
Now, I wonder how it feels playing a horn whose range is higher than your vocal range.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a good question. But it's a question of the imagination and the compensation. And again, as I said before, I have a good inner ear.
Mm-hmm.
In the inner ear is no problem of hearing much higher. I don't have to sing it outwardly. I sing it inside. So the inner mechanism is just as good as the outer one. You don't have to actually sing sometimes. You can hear it singing inside.
A few years ago, you gave up smoking after, I think, about 30 years of a pack a day.
Yeah, that's right.
Are you still not smoking?
That's right. Yeah, no, I never went back to
nicotine. Was there a kind of breaking point for you where you thought, like, I can't do this anymore?
That's right. It was, well, actually, that same lesson from this Japanese, who I might as well name, Watazumi Doso, who died a few years ago, he was the absolute master of a shakuhachi flute. And that was part of the first lesson that he gave me. He says, stop smoking, you know. But that was 1976, I think. And I didn't stop smoking for 5 more years.
Oh, but so it's been a long time that you haven't been smoking. And did you use any technique, or did
yeah.
you realize the importance of stopping so much that you were just able to do it on your
own? I had a good time stopping. I didn't find it difficult. I found it fun, and it made me very nervous. And I sort of had the heebie-jeebies for a while, but I enjoyed them because at least it was new. I like, you know, I strive for some kind of freshness, some kind of quality of newness, and even in life, too. And there was a situation where I stopped smoking all of a sudden, and it was a shock. It was weird. It made me nervous. It made me... but I was in a hotel room. I had a couple of days off on a tour I was at, and I decided not to start. I didn't stop smoking. I couldn't stop smoking, but I could not start. I just kept delaying. I didn't buy any, and I just stayed in a hotel room and had the heebie-jeebies for a while. And I enjoyed that, you know. And then the whole day went by, and I said, wow. Phew. And I went to sleep, and then woke up the next morning, and I said, wow, you know, and I didn't find it difficult. I found it fun, really.
Steve Lacy, recorded in 1997. Lacy lives in Paris. He's now on an American tour. Tonight he plays in Long Beach, California, and then he goes on to San Diego, Berkeley, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, Eugene, Carmel, Tucson, Albuquerque, Austin, New Orleans, Philadelphia, New York, Washington, D.C., Cambridge, Worcester, Buffalo, and Erie. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Serta, maker of the Serta Perfect Sleeper Mattress, helping generations of Americans to sleep since 1931. Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Return of Little Big Man, the sequel to Thomas Berger's Little Big Man, in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
There's a new film based on the TV series The Mod Squad. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from one of the original squad members, Clarence Williams, who played Link. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.